Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
The combination of trust, experience, neutrality, and secrecy were the foundations of Switzerland's reputation as a centre for private banking. And despite globalisation, regulation, disclosures and competition from all quarters, Swiss financial institutions have maintained their position of influence, with three in the top 10 of global wealth managers. So today we're going to talk to one of these, not the household names of UBS and Credit Suisse, but another, with $500 billion of assets, a lower profile, and a significant international operator. And to help probe this landscape, I have the CEO of Julius Baer International, David Durlacher, with me today. David, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure being on here. I am a fan of the show. I've heard a number of the podcasts before, so it's great to be part of it.
Pleasure. We are sitting here in London, away from the Swiss snow-capped peaks, the gold vaults and delicious chocolate, to talk about the evolving world of wealth management. And I note this morning the Swiss have moved to be much more flexible on their entry requirements for Brits, pragmatism once more in stark contrast to their French neighbours. So I hope we can discuss what's changing in the needs of wealthy clients, how you're responding, how difficult it is to serve various international markets and client bases, asset allocation decisions, families debating selling versus retaining their businesses, and more. But let's just start with you, David. How did this journey into private banking, wealth management start?
For me personally, banking has been in the blood. My family has been in the banking world for many generations, and several Durlachers have graced the halls of the banking sphere in London over many generations. And so it was perhaps inevitable, given that every kitchen table, lunch and dinner involved conversations about the city and about markets, it was inevitable that I would end up following my dad and my grandfather's train. But I joined into an American institution, which I guess my grandfather would have been surprised at the differences from his era, and then into Julius Baer when Merrill Lynch sold its international wealth management business. And I have headed up the business of Julius Baer International here in the UK now for several years. It's a fantastic business.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about the challenges of international, and I have some perspective because Morgan Stanley, where I was for a long period, had the international challenge, which it exited from in large part, and we'll come back to that. But I guess let's just start with the 500 feet perspective. Julius Baer International and Julius Baer, from which the genesis is. Just tell me a little bit about the evolution of Julius Baer.
We're no newcomer. We have been around for 130 years, set up by Julius Baer himself, a real individual in Switzerland who set out to establish a very different type of firm, a firm that just concentrated on doing one thing and doing that one thing incredibly well. And we have done private banking and just private banking for 130 years, 50 years here in the UK. We have 5 operations here, but we operate all around the world, from Montevideo and Mumbai to here more locally in Manchester. And the aim of our business is very simple. We just, from the chair of the board of directors to the newest apprentice, we focus on looking after the wealthiest individuals and their really complex needs around the world and trying to make sense of the complexity of the world's markets and the world's politics.
So I want to start by talking about family and family transitions, because I have read that one of the effects or consequences of COVID has been to force or encourage families to think about that. Do they pass on the business to the next generation or do they sell it? And I just wonder, when you get involved with such families, how does the conversation typically go?
The government tends to talk a bit about levelling up here in the UK. We tend to talk about levelling with. What we are trying to do is to make sure that we understand the conversations and the dynamics that are at play within individual families. And as you say, some of those multi-generational families have got very complex situations. They may have businesses that have been with those families for several generations. They may have been businesses that have been set up by an individual entrepreneur. We understand those dynamics and we understand the emotions that are often involved. Lockdowns around the world have prompted some of those emotions to come more to the fore, as the thoughts of mortality, the thoughts of the bigger plan, what's the bigger purpose, have come more into families' minds. And we have helped people to navigate that. It is a complex decision. Do I think about handing over the business to my son or daughter? Do I think about potentially not handing over my business to my son and daughter, but maybe to a professional and taking the family out, which is actually what happened with the Baer family originally. It became ultimately a public company. Do I think actually about selling the business? These are complex decisions, and it involves a lot of emotion. We need to make sure that we can level with those clients, help them to navigate that discussion, and to also navigate the discussions across the generations. Sometimes that generational divide needs a little bit of translation. We understand that.
And you've been doing this long enough to have seen this process operate. Do you think that this generation is in some ways more resistant to following the parental path, or has it always been thus?
I don't think that they are more resistant to following the parental path. And I think of one entrepreneur who I know who has handed over his business to his daughter, who has just turned 40. Her vision for the business, which is a Midlands-based global technology business, is very different from her father's, who founded the company. But her vision will energize and provide a new level of direction for that business that will take it forward into a new generation. And in many respects, yes, that next generation has family loyalty. They have a desire not to see the business fail. They want to see it succeed, but they will have a new vision and they will refine it and adapt it and make it more nimble. And ultimately, that is the heart of entrepreneurism. It is nimbleness. It is finding opportunity amongst obstacle. And we see that in spades around the world occurring. We see it in spades across the UK. And people point to headlines that talk of the obstacles. We see people who find actually opportunity, not obstacle.
We're going to talk about the international complexity, as I mentioned later on, but broadly, and I accept that this question has the danger of prompting a generalization, how do you think the requirements of a wealthy client have changed over the last 2 decades or are changing right now?
Fundamentally, those requirements haven't changed. The requirements are very simple: protection of capital, opportunity in the markets. Use wisdom in order to navigate, to find where opportunity and where value exists. Where they have evolved, though, is how purpose comes into it. So the conversation has been very clear around governments, it's been clear around companies, that without purpose, there is very little direction. That is now coming increasingly into the minds of wealthy individuals. And seeing that purpose-driven decision-making has been a very noticeable shift in the past 5 years in particular, and I expect that to continue. So that has prompted the resurgence of sustainable investing. It has prompted a decision around philanthropy. It has prompted a decision as to how wealth is put to work. It is not just wealth for wealth's sake. It's wealth for a purpose. And so part of our job as private bankers or wealth managers has to be to pull back from the what is my risk? What is my return? It is more, what is the purpose of my wealth? What am I trying to achieve with it? And how do we as a wealth manager help you to achieve that goal?
A cynic would say, crowded landscape, lots of people offering wealth offerings, really pretty tough to differentiate other than the branding. Why would a client come to Julius Baer?
Why does a client go to any wealth manager? Arguably, you've got a lot of people who would say, just follow indices, go to passive trackers and be done with it. Don't pay the fees. Why do people trust wealth managers? Quite simply, it is two things. Firstly, culture. Secondly, people. The culture has to be clear. The culture is either a universal bank where they try to do all things and be all things to all people, or they are, as at Julius Baer, we just do one thing. Every single part of our business is focused on investing for private clients. It is cultural, but it is also personal. We have some of the best people in the industry, not just private bankers, but also people involved in every single part of our organization, from operations to risk, through to compliance, through to HR, people who really are at the top of their game. All of these people are working to make sure that we are there to do the best possible job for clients wherever they are based. And that ultimately then is tested through value for money. And so trust comes through culture, it comes through people, but it comes also in delivery. If you don't deliver and you can't deliver what a client is looking for, then you don't deserve to charge the fees that you do.
So David, let's jump into this international question right now. For the areas for which you're responsible, you clearly have to recognize that there are different tax regimes, legal jurisdictions, even client appetite in terms of risk tolerance from some parts of Southern Europe to parts of Northern Europe. You can't simply cut and paste the portfolio approach that works in one geography. How do you deal with that?
You're right, that complexity is increased as you look at international. But I think most clients are international. They have international businesses. It's rare to find people who have an entirely domestic focus. So you need to understand those complexities. You need to understand the tax jurisdictions you operate across if you're a business entrepreneur, and you need to understand that as a wealth manager. We have to customize what we do to each person. And so we don't take a cookie-cutter approach of trying to do the same thing for everybody. We have to adapt it, and therefore we have a high degree of sophistication as to what we develop for each particular client. But ultimately, there has to be a clear view on making sure that people are positioned well around the world in whatever business operations as well as their personal wealth. That is what we do.
So I'm going to come back to my earlier comment, because Morgan Stanley had a international practice, but in the end, it decided to sell its international business, a little bit like Merrill Lynch did, which you know because of the complexities and the inability to scale, which is so different from a vast universe like the US as deep capital markets and homogeneity. How do you go about practically building a business that can operate in those jurisdictions?
You need to have boots on the ground where you are located. So you need to have proximity to the client, because people want proximity. They don't want suitcase bankers. But you need to have a depth of understanding of those local markets. Let me give an example. We've got a client who signed up with us. We have over 100 million with him here in London. But he came to us because we are on the ground in Thailand and we have one of the strongest businesses in Thailand. We really understand that local economy, and he trades actively with Thailand. He needs to know that the wealth manager he deals with in London really understands the markets he operates in commercially. We have another client who looked for expertise that we have in Japan. We've got clients who have property in France or property in Spain. They need to know that actually they can have a local wealth management relationship in Spain or in Monaco or in Germany where they are there, but also make sure that they've got that global view. So yes, it is complex operating internationally. Yes, you have got to understand the legal environment, the regulatory environment, the tax environment. But it is where clients are. That is the nature of their lives. It is the nature of their businesses.
So let's just stay with that idea of international dispersion. And I now want to talk about investment appetite, because one is aware that the Asian body, generalization again, like to transact more. Their mindset has evolved in a different way to many in Europe who are happy to have a more sedentary portfolio management, by which I mean to hand over the discretion to a manager. The business needs to be able to offer those two different channels. I'd like to understand how you've done that, because some banks have clearly decided that's not workable to have the active advisory sitting next to the discretionary.
We encourage that blend. And if I think of the business we have here in the UK, yes, we have got a large percentage of that that is in discretion, but we have a large percentage of it that is actively advised. And if I think of many clients, yes, they want to have a core of their portfolio, which is that long-term play, because let's face it, asset allocation drives a lot of return. Whatever percentage it is argued over. But they want to be able to be nimble and take advantage of local short-term trends or moves in the market where they can take an active play. We therefore tend to see clients take not one or the other, but a blend of both. And that enables that to work. In Asia, yes, it is a smaller percentage in discretionary, but we're seeing increasing interest in wealth planning amongst our clients in Asia, a trend that has been long established already in Europe.
I note when I was reading some of your materials that you have a large financing business, lending. Your clients want to borrow. Debt, some of us old-timers would argue, is seriously mispriced to the advantage of the borrower, particularly in an inflationary environment. What are you seeing in terms of what's the appetite of wealthy folks who may have built businesses and don't need to take on debt, but still thinking about debt in this world?
Debt is indeed cheap, and for that reason, it is used increasingly as a means of extending the amount of exposure to the markets. But it is also the case that firms like Julius Baer are able to look a little bit more at how that debt comes. It doesn't need to necessarily come from a collateral within a portfolio. It can come from more illiquid investments, including private company holdings. The extent to which it's used has to be with caution, because rates are not always this low. And if you have a long memory back, actually, it's not going to be the case that credit has always been as popular as it is now. So I think we'd want to have that long view when advising clients, the extent to which they leverage their portfolios or the extent to which they take out loans in order to deploy for their business needs or personal interests. But it is clearly a major part of the investment landscape for most clients.
And if we flip to the other side of the balance sheet, the investment universe has broadened to incorporate more and more private assets, courtesy of the absence of yield anywhere in the world worth speaking of, with all of the attendant potential dangers. How do you think about that private asset pool?
That private asset pool is indeed very important for, in particular, the ultra high net worth family offices. We do see a number of people taking a very active play in the private market space. And we also advise clients in that space as well. We have a number of private transactions which we facilitate for those ultra high net worth clients. I don't think it is for everybody. And I think for the majority of people listening to this, actually the best way of getting return is not through private market transactions. It is through the markets. What our job has to be, though, as wealth managers, is to excite people about those public markets. I think for a number of, especially younger investors, they're turned off by the smaller levels of return that you can get through the public markets. And that is a job that we have got to do, because there is a risk otherwise that we will come across as boring. Investing as it traditionally has been is not boring, and yet it runs that risk. There was a study done a couple of years ago which looked at younger high net worth investors, and they by and large classified themselves as conservative and yet had a growth expectation, return expectation of over 10% per annum. And I don't see that those two things square with how generally conservative portfolios across standard benchmarks have performed. So there is an education job that we have got to do if people aren't to go at the wrong levels into private markets and to take on risk and illiquidity that they may not have familiarity with.
To paraphrase, is that risk appetite has grown as asset prices have gone up and the sexier stuff is the one that's attracted more and more. And yet, I think 100 years of US stock market history shows average nominal returns of a little over 9%. So when you're reaching for 10 and more, it does imply more risk-taking at the time where the cycle might be turning. And maybe, and this is what I want to talk about now, a different environment to the one that we have seen for the last 20 years arrives. So let's just talk about how you're thinking about portfolio construction. Inflation has picked up. There's obviously the argument rages about whether it's going to go back down and settle. And I've made my view quite clear on this podcast about why I suspect it's going to prove to be stickier. But how do you expect client portfolios to change in a lower return, perhaps more stagflationary world? Or maybe you don't think that's happening and therefore you're not even moving in that direction. Tell me about your portfolios today.
If we'd had this conversation 2 years ago, I'd have described the bull market as the most hated in history. I think that at that time, there were many people who speculated that it would be over and it was only a matter of when rather than if. The impact of COVID has been to reset the markets. The level of fiscal stimulus, the level of intervention, almost a state-sponsored capitalism, has meant that we have a very different markets environment now than we did a couple of years ago. That said, I think we still face similar sorts of questions coming up. Where does inflation go? And there is much speculation, as you've commented in past podcasts. We do see, indeed, much speculation. Is inflation going to be stickier than expected, or is it going to be more short-lived than expected? We see some noise in markets around potential peaking of energy prices, around potentially the peaking of consumer demand in the US, potentially some degree of wage inflation growth that is not quite as high as had been expected. It is possible that inflation will not go to the levels that has been predicted. If that is the case, then I would not expect us to end up with the stagflationary approach that you mention. Employment rates, we do expect to continue to rise. But in a higher inflationary environment, we do need to therefore keep an eye on how that growth versus value debate plays out. And we've seen clearly value has been the winner so far this year. I do expect, though, that growth ultimately will be the winner from COVID. And if you look at those core sectors of IT, of healthcare, they have shown themselves to be strong beneficiaries of COVID. And I don't think that that will be a short-term thing. But yes, a higher inflationary environment will benefit financials. And we've clearly seen some of the results coming through.
So you write on your website about being a sparring partner for your clients and getting the balance right when you have client vision and views, and often they've run private businesses very different from deploying their assets in portfolios, requires some frank conversations. What do you mean by being a sparring partner?
A sparring partner is someone who is on a level with a client. It's sometimes helping them pull back from the noise. It's very easy to see emotion coming into the minds of investors. And a sparring partner is there to effectively try and strip back the emotion and help someone to see with a little bit more clarity. I think of the oft-quoted example of Amazon. If you'd bought it at, $5 on its first day, you'd have been very tempted to sell it in under 2 years at $85. Or when it crashed on the 2001 crisis and back down to $6, you'd have definitely wanted to sell. But the benefit of that perspective, the sparring, that challenging of emotion, what is the bigger picture, means that investors are able to stay the course. And so I tend to encourage people to bring out the binoculars, not the microscope, when they look at the markets. Our job is to try and help people to see the bigger picture, not just to look for the immediate short-term opportunity.
wasn't me, but the wise words that were issued about it's not timing the market, it's time in the market in terms of compounding long-term returns. But as Japan's shown us, bear markets can linger longer than anyone would wish, despite very cheap money. I want to talk about currency because wealthy families becoming increasingly global may have defaulted historically to the dollar as a reference currency, and that might set the portfolio's currency reference. If we look at the long-term history of the currencies that have survived and done a half-decent job at preserving purchasing power, it's been the yen and, of course, the Swiss franc. The dollar's lost 99% of its purchasing power in the last 100 years. How do you go about having that conversation with clients about the currency reference makeup approach?
A lot of that currency reference is going to depend primarily on where the client's business or personal exposure lies, and trying to make sure that you do not end up in a mismatch there. So clearly, if someone is a UK-based investor with a UK-based business, sterling will be the primary reference for them rather than dollar. But dollar is, if I think of our clients, a dollar is a key reference point, especially as you look at more global clients and more global exposure. Though trying to game the currency markets as a private client is difficult. And so, yes, we will provide forecasts and we will try and provide some bigger picture as to how those currencies play out from the dollar to the yen to the franc to the euro. But the fundamental has to be, where is the client's biggest exposure personally and commercially?
But do you not see that there is a tension in this, that you take a currency like the dollar, which has historically been weak in terms of its purchasing power, you reference a client in dollars because that's how they think. The declining currency can flatter returns, but their global purchasing power may not have improved, in fact, may have reversed.
That is indeed true. And so therefore, you end up with currency trades that enable you to get exposure to other currencies. In a portfolio, that is normal. And that is what we do on a regular basis, advise people on how to get that exposure right. Otherwise, you end up being impacted, as you described.
I can't help but ask you this, because when I started in the business, every Swiss bank had a proper allocation to gold, by which I mean proper would have been 5 to 7%, as of course happens over cycles, moods change. How would you categorize the conversation around gold for the families with whom you operate?
Gold is rarely something that clients ask for. We have some clients who hold physical gold exposure ingots, but mostly it is a diversification, a non-correlation rather than an investment per se. Think of the standard portfolio investment theory. It is all about how do you get non-correlation between assets. And that is really where gold or other precious metals or any other alternative comes in. You need to make sure that you've got that blend. There is a speculation, is the 60-40 equity bond mix going to be at an end, or do we see the standard portfolio theory being written out by the current markets? I don't see ultimately that will be the case, because you need to create that non-correlation. You need to create that diversification.
It's just go back to the landscape for wealth management and private banking. As I said earlier on, the top three are Swiss, but the rest are, not surprisingly, essentially US orientated. How does this world change? Because certainly, talking to some of the quite senior folks I know who sit in these US institutions, they continue to worry about money laundering, unexpected disclosures, the sort of things that have come to haunt all sorts of institutions. Let's just dial forward 7-10 years. How does this private wealth landscape shake up?
It is a transparent landscape. It is one where information transfer across jurisdictions, across tax authorities, is the norm. And perhaps that was not quite so normal historically. Changes in regulation over the past 5-10 years have ensured that the landscape today is very different from where it was. Where it will go in the future is, I think, increasingly global. And that therefore requires that portability of information. That global landscape needs to be understood by a wealth manager. We need to be able to help clients to navigate that world across their tax affairs, across their legal setup, as well as their wealth. And I do see that as being ultimately for the benefit of clients. One of the things we have noticed in the past 20 years in particular has been an increasing level of due diligence that is done on clients. That can sometimes feel intrusive for clients. However, its purpose is really to just understand. And in doing that, we have, as an industry, developed stronger relationships with our clients. No longer are we all about risk and return. We're about the person that's underneath that. For all of the complexity of their financial affairs, understanding that person is fundamental if we are in 5-10 years' time to really be able to serve them. It will not just be an algorithm that does this for a client. It has to be the depth of insight that comes from people. And so, yes, I think that the industry will face some challenges. A lot of speculation has been, will we end up with digital banking as being the replacement for people? I do not see that happening. In the coming decade, yes, there will be fewer operators that can afford to put the level of investment we have in people. But where they do that, they will end up with a far deeper relationship with their clients they serve.
So let's talk about tax, because governments have made themselves significantly more indebted courtesy of their responses to COVID, depending on their starting position, and the way in which the redress will happen, one suspects, and one's seeing already with global tax nets being drawn in and corporate taxes rising and trying to reverse any sense of the race to the bottom, but individuals are unlikely to escape this global tax scrutiny. I think you as an institution advise on tax, but you're not accountants. And so I'd just like to understand to what extent Julius Baer International will entertain conversations around tax.
We are not tax advisors, so we are not authorized to give tax advice. That is a regulated activity that we do not provide. However, we do understand the tax impact for residents and people who have exposure to a whole range of economies around the world and tax jurisdictions around the world. Understanding that is fundamental. Tax goes alongside one of the biggest issues for an investor. And making sure that you understand that tax consequence of investing around the world is as fundamental as it is for an individual's business. We spend a lot of time trying to make sure that people are correctly positioned, that they've got the right disclosures, they don't get into difficulties down the road. And making sure that that efficiency also is produced at a portfolio level is a very helpful part of return.
My last question on Julius Baer is that it's the least well-known of those top 10 managers. And I wonder whether you think that's an advantage to be a lower profile operator in the wealth management space whilst being one of the top 10. How do you reconcile these two positions?
We are, I think, known for doing what we do. And I prefer to have a reputation that means that we gain clients largely through referrals from existing clients than have a reputation that is built through billboards. It is true that brand counts, and every business, regardless of sector, will know that their reputation is linked to their brand. But I want our business in Julius Baer here in the UK to be really well known for being darn good at what it does, at its delivery, at its quality of its people. Its reputation as it comes through an individual person, not through its public profile. 130 years is no small amount of time to be doing what we do. We know what we do well, and we will be here in another 130 years' time. We don't need to be the biggest name in 130 years' time.
Tell me a little bit about that UK equation, because you've made a defined effort to build out your presence in the UK. I think you're going to tell me in a minute where you are in the UK. But just tell me a little bit of why it's become a particular focus for Julius Baer.
Julius Baer opened its business in the UK 50 years ago. We know the market well. It is a key wealth center globally, not just for a domestic wealth, but also as a financial center. We have built that business now. It is one of the largest parts of Julius Baer Global. And yet, we see that opportunity continuing to evolve despite the headwinds of Brexit, despite the question marks that exist around the UK economy. We have a strong conviction in the wealth that is being created here. And if I look at where that wealth is being created, it is being created across almost every single sector across the UK. We started out in London. We have now 5 offices across the UK, from Belfast and Edinburgh, Leeds and Knutsford, as well as here. And we have a very large operations centre in Guernsey as well. We have a proximity to where those local economies are. We understand them. We have some of the best people in wealth management who are operating from those locations. And yet these people are able to tap into global economies. They have the sophistication of operating and understanding what our investment thought is in South America, in the Middle East, in Asia, as much as in Europe and the States. And that proximity, but that global presence, is key to us.
So, David, I'd like to just ask you a couple of closing general questions. You were schooled or brought up into a banking environment, but tell me, was there one particular setback or mistake on your journey from which you learned an important lesson?
There are, in the minds of every business leader, areas where they could have done better, where they could have made a decision faster, or they didn't make a decision which they have come to regret. There are many things that I have looked back on and say, yes, I could have taken a different course of action. But I think we learn from our mistakes potentially more than we learn from our successes. And how you learn from those, it makes you as a leader. I always worry about people who don't make mistakes because they never learn. And it is in our nature to need to learn if we are to have wisdom. From wisdom comes an awful lot of experience of doing things wrong as well as right.
Yes, but they just don't fess up to them. Switching tack, I understand that on your non-working days, you travel and you visited some of the Coptic churches in Africa. Is that right?
That is right, yes. I went around Ethiopia. I've been into the deserts of Sudan. My mother used to be an archaeologist, and so I grew up with a passion for going around dusty ruins. And that is still an interest that I have. I love the Middle East as a region. I learned Arabic in SOAS a few years ago through night classes. It is a strong interest of mine still going around some of those archaeological remains. Sometimes we can learn something from the past that can carry into the future.
David, I would suspect, and correct me if I'm wrong there, that underlying that is a faith, that religion might play a part in your life. And if it does, how do you think about that in a world of investing and maximizing returns?
My faith is the most important thing in my life. My Christian faith has grounded me, it's provided me with perspective, and it gives me a context, a worldview that has been helpful to me. How does it impact my view of investing? Well, I guess from a Christian view, I would say that ultimately I will die. And when I die, or any of our clients die, I will not take anything with me to the grave. Therefore, investing is limited. All of the wealth, all of the success, all of the popularity an individual may have, whether they're in politics or in business or in banking, is only going to go with them up to a certain point. So life is short. And I recognize that for all of our clients, yes, wealth is important. There has to be a purpose. There has to be an aim for what we're doing. But ultimately, life is more than a bank balance. And having that perspective is really important for us. It keeps us grounded. So yes, I love what I do. I love the clients who we work for. I think that work is really impactful. We're making a difference for the livelihoods and the success of families around the world. But I recognize that ultimately there is a bigger picture.
David, that's really nice to hear, and thank you. And I don't think we've had that conversation on the Money Maze podcast in our 55 interviews, so I appreciate you being so honest. A couple of things I'm going to take away. You as an institution, Julius Baer International, are positive on UK wealth creation. And I think that is interesting because, as I have maybe said on the show before, I think there's been too much negativity around the UK, and it's easy to find reasons to be negative when there are headwinds. And also what you just said is life is short and you keeping grounded is extremely important. So, David, I'd like to thank you very much for your time today and for sharing your perspectives on your universe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.